Box to Box Stoppage Time.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Great savings every day.
And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices.
Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box Stoppage Time. You're with Rob Gilbert, Derek Dyson and Willem van Denderen for our podcast where we go through our highlights of the past week. Some teams, some moments, ones you'll know, some you don't, a few obscure ones, a few well-known ones. Derek and Willem, a massive show lined up this week. It was pretty hard to choose, wasn't it? I know we sort of crossed over each other's territory a little there, Derek, before we all settled on our selections.
Well, I think it's an FA Cup lockout, Rob. And to be honest, a few that round generally didn't disappoint. I think there were 20 goals over the four matches that were played and some great narratives in each of the games. So I'm looking forward to taking you through my one, but listening to everyone else's picks too.
All right. Well, look, Willem, why don't you come out of the gates? I know I've got one of the Rippers. I know Derek has too. So you get us started, brother.
Yeah, I'll kick off with Chelsea and Leicester. This did have it all, as Derek alluded to. First half, Chelsea opened up through Mark Cucurella, one of many, many players who was brilliant at their former club, was bought for an absolute packet and hasn't quite hit the heights at Stamford Bridge, but he was drifting in at the back post to score first here. From there, the rest of the first half was the ballad of Raheem Sterling, for worse and for better. He was cleaned out and earned himself a penalty, but from there, Derek, he insisted on taking it despite Cole Palmer having slotted his last five, and it was an awful penalty, an absolute stinker. I'll throw to you for a comment on it before continuing.
Yeah, Raheem Sterling has now converted only 50% of his penalties in his whole career, so it's not a great statistic. And as you said, even though he is the senior of Cole Palmer, surely he was the man to step up and take this kick. And as you said, it was a pretty woeful penalty, and I think, as you'll go on to say, it wasn't the last woeful set piece that was Sterling was involved in.
No, it wasn't. Although he did later sort of burst through the Leicester defence and square one up for Palmer. So it was 2-0 at half time. One of their centre backs, though, Chelsea, De Zazzi, turned in an absolute disaster of a back pass to Robert Sanchez from 30 odd metres out. So that was one of the longer own goals you'll see. And then Steffi Mavididi equalised at 2-2 with a long curling goal. Goal that reminded me a little bit of Papi Cisse, the former Newcastle striker, who, as a visiting player at Stamford Bridge, scored a couple of absolute bangers, which still headline pretty much every Premier League highlights package ever. From there, there was a red card, a Chukwuemeka penalty, or rather winner, that was set up with a little 1-2 with Palmer. I'll ask you again about him in a moment, Derek. And then in the 98th minute, the best of the lot, a really muscular solo effort from Nodi Madueke to protect the ball from a couple of Leicester players and sink it from distance. So it was Leicester 4-2, four goals from outside the box, and the sliding prospects of Cole Palmer and Raheem Sterling as Gareth Southgate looks to pick his Euro squad on full display here. Palmer, the absolute star at 21, and Sterling at 29, unfortunately looking like his best is well behind him.
Yeah, the Chelsea fans actually booed when Sterling wasn't the first Chelsea substitution. It was Mikhailo Mudryk, I think, who came off first, and there was a noticeable booing around the ground that it wasn't Sterling. So he's obviously not enamoured himself to the Chelsea faithful. Of course, he's played for a few rival clubs of Chelsea down the years, Liverpool and Manchester City. He's obviously on the big bucks too. And look, quite often, how do I put this? The context that goes around young, talented and rich black players often doesn't go down well with home fans as well. It can often be demonised. And, you know, I sort of feel sorry for him in a way, actually, even though he's in such a privileged position. Cole Palmer, on the other hand, though, everyone looking at that going, you know, why did Man City let him go as they did with Sterling? You can see the Sterling, why they did it with Sterling, but Cole Palmer, what a talent. But I believe that Guardiola, in a heart-to-heart with him, just couldn't guarantee the minutes and games that he wanted. He didn't want to do what Phil Foden had to do, which was, you know, wait 3 or 4 years to slowly break into the team. And he's just showing that he's pure quality now. So he's been a rare bright spot in what's been a pretty dark season for Chelsea. But of course, they march on into the semi-finals, and of course the narrative is they will play Manchester City next. So chance for Palmer and Sterling to get revenge on their old club.
It wasn't the only person booed, I think, before the comeback. Maurizio Pochettino was on the end of the ire of the shit end as well. So, look, we've got a few other games to get through. So let's shift to yours, Derek, before I wrap it up with another epic fifth-round FA Cup tie.
Yeah, I went early, as I usually do, and went for one of the earlier FA Cup quarterfinals, and that was Wolves versus Coventry City. And I picked this because it was just a brilliant game for a start. Coventry ended up winning away at Molineux 3-2. Bit of a ding-dong battle. And, of course, these are local rivals as well. There's not too much difference between Wolves and Coventry. Two clubs with great FA Cup pedigree and a great local rivalry. The most amazing thing about this game was that it was 0-0 at half-time, so all the goals came in the second half, and Coventry finally went in front. Eight, Nouri equalises for Wolves, and then Bueno put them ahead 2-1. And the commentator, Jonathan Pearce, who is a commentator I like, actually. I mean, he's pretty hyperbolic, like some of our favourite commentators, but he's one of the good guys, I think. He called that as a winner for Wolves at 2-1. He said, that's the winner. It seals the winner, poor old Coventry. And then, of course, on 90 plus 7 minutes, Sims gets the equaliser for Coventry. And then Wright scores a brilliant strike on 90 plus 10 minutes, leading to absolute scenes in the away end. And you'll notice for all of these games, because it's FA Cup, there's a much bigger away contingent than usual. Usually they take up one goal, so those scenes were outstanding. And I suppose the thing that I'd point out the most is just, again, another game that's decided by well into stoppage time. You know, 88 minutes, Jonathan Pearce in normal circumstances was right, the game was over, but there was 12 minutes left, and of course that's enough time to score two goals. So this new paradigm of football that we're in, where we're playing 100 minute matches, the game is not over at 90 minutes, gents.
No, absolutely not. And this next game that I'm going to go to, I mean, you started at a level that we would have thought was not going to be beat. But as Willem's already gone through, other games just kept on meeting the standard. And this one was one of them that I'm about to talk to. I mean, there's just some times where a game of football, you know, demands to find itself in your rundown. And as disappointing as the result was from a Liverpool supporter's view, the match between them and Manchester United is one of those that, you know, as you've already said about the previous match, was thankfully narrated by the voice we think is reserved for these special occasions.
Elliot robbed. Here's Garnacho. Ahmad, who stole the ball, gets it back from Garnacho. For the young man, can he make himself a hero? He has done. It's Manchester United's quarter-final. In classic Manchester United fashion, the counter-attack, and a youngster doing it as well, the Busby Babes, the Fergie fledglings, and now Ten Hag has sent on Ahmad Diallo, who's hardly had a chance.
Yeah, this game had everything. Now, I know, Derek, you're going to touch on the travails at Old Trafford in your hot topic, but this game at the Theatre of Dreams against a bitter rival, well, as another friend of the show, Henry Winter, wrote in the Times, all United fans crave this, not only keeping their own season alive and booking a trip to Wembley, but also damaging Jurgen Klopp's farewell tour and the Fab Four trophy narrative. This was an instant FA Cup classic, 7 goals, including 4 in extra time. The home side conceded an early lead, grabbed an equaliser in the shadows of the final whistle, and sent the home crowd into delirium. Harvey Elliott snatched back the lead for the Reds before Marcus Rashford equalised. And then, as Martin Tyler so fabulously described, it was the 21-year-old Ahmad Diallo who hoisted Jurgen Klopp on his own petard of young guns and grabbed a double in the space of a minute. And again, to quote Henry, on a classic FA Cup weekend, the game was a reminder of the enduring allure of the Cup. Two teams giving everything, two managers throwing everything at the game, two sets of supporters shouting and chanting incessantly, and two Liverpool greats, so Kenny Dalglish and Ian Rush, sitting side by side in the director's box and kicking every ball from afar. It was that sort of match, utterly absorbing, even for those who have seen and done it all. If you haven't watched it, you owe it to yourself to at least catch the highlights. I mean, that was a round of FA Cup. And if anyone said that the FA Cup is done and dusted, those games that we've just talked about now put the light of that, don't they, Derek?
They certainly do. It was a chaotic game. I think probably to Liverpool's detriment, they would have liked that word that Guardiola likes, control over the ball, control over the park. But because United almost they kind of created chaos in the way that they were constantly attacking and being quite unstructured, I think Liverpool got sucked into that, and then it just turned into a shooting match at the end. And you know, Erik ten Hag, just when you think he's down, pulls off what looks like an absolute masterclass, and you know, we'll go on. And the irony of irony is they're now playing Coventry in the semi-final, Manchester United, the other one being Manchester City versus Chelsea. We've already said that narrative. The narrative for this one is that Mark Robbins is the Coventry coach. Mark Robbins is a former Manchester United player, and he's a scorer of the goal that everyone says kept Alex Ferguson in a job when he scored a winner for Manchester United in a League Cup game. Manchester United went on to win that League Cup, and they were thinking of sacking Alex Ferguson back in the late 80s. So Robbins is back, and how ironic he'll be there when Ten Hag's future is probably on the line now.
Yeah, what a narrative. That's just amazing. Right, well, boys, we've got to get through our teams of the week and hot topics. So I'm going to come off my team of the week first. Now, this one is a close to the heart for me. The Lebanon men's side is my team of the week ahead of their World Cup qualifiers against Australia. Now, as eagle-eared listeners to the show might recall, my dear mum was born in the mountain village of Hattin before emigrating to Australia as a five-year-old in 1938. You know, and we often talk, football people, supporters, journalists, talk about what football can do to uplift the spirits of a nation. And, you know, in this case, it's all relative. You know, for Australia, it's nearly two decades, can you believe, since that World Cup drought ended. But for the Lebanese, who've been a confederation since before the first World Cup, they've just never qualified. And that's why I like the expansion of the World Cup to 48 teams, which is another story altogether. In a quote I found in Al Jazeera, this is an indication of the way different games at different levels of qualifying can uplift nations. The country erupted in joyous celebrations when Lebanon defeated the mighty South Korea in the 2014 World Cup qualifiers. So this is just a win in qualifying. So you know, they had a steady decline in the rankings from 98 to 2016, but they jumped 66 places in a period leading up to 2018. They got to their top level of 77. They often rely on their international diaspora, including three Australians. Buddy Farah, he'd been a part of Raul Blanco's preliminary squad for Australia for the 2000 Olympics. He had 10 caps for the under-23 squad. Michael Redder in the same era. Now, currently, Bankstown-born Yaha El-Hindi is a member of the squad, and you can be sure that in Parramatta, which is just up the road from where I grew up, and there are a lot of Lebanese around that area, and Canberra, there's a lot of Lebanese. I know I've referred that. The one of the best football nicknames in football, the Cedars of Lebanon, will represent this ancient and proud country as a beacon, and the support will be absolutely loud. And you know what, Willem? They also allow me to add in a movie reference, which you rightly pointed out I'd overlooked a couple of weeks ago. I wonder if you might sort of recognise the tune that's playing, and if you don't, then get your Shazam out. Is that what it's called? Either of you get it?
That is Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On.
From which movie?
Titanic.
Exactly. Now, why would I reference the Titanic in Lebanon? Well, the Titanic, as Derek and I listened to another fabulous podcast called The Rest is History, and Dominic Sandbrook and Tom Holland, the hosts of that show, have just done a 6-episode series on the Titanic. And in that, I heard a piece of information that my sitter, my grandmother, referred to many, many years ago, and that was that a couple of members of our extended family were meant to be on the Titanic, but they'd gotten sick. And I just shifted it to the back of my memory somewhere. Then I hear these two historians talk about the Titanic and how it was an immigrant ship and that how there were 79 Lebanese on board. And then they reference this little village town where my family come from in Hardin, up in the mountains in Lebanon. And I jump online and I find the story. And look, I know I'm going on a little bit longer, but everyone knows the story of how the band played on as the ship sank. Another story that actually happened is that the Lebanese did a dance called the Dubka, which is very similar to the Greek dance that we're all familiar with. And it's often danced at funerals. And they were dancing the dance because they knew they were dying on the deck of the Titanic. And this was reported afterwards by some of the survivors. So that is my movie reference with my team of the week, and a piece of information that goes back to my childhood from my grandmother, and a fact that I'm very, very pleased, gentlemen, to remember. Willem, was that to the pop culture standard this show has come to expect?
100%. No, it was comprehensive. It was personal. It was well-delivered, Rob. Everything we expect from you week to week on Box to Box. Although I must say, when you set it all up and you threw to us, what's the link? How are we going
to
get that?
No, I just wanted you to know what the movie was. I didn't want you to ask what the... I never expected that. I just wanted you to know for the movie. And, you know, Derek's pulled it out of it. And I know how much he loves Celine Dion. He's a huge fan. He's got all of her material. Sees her whenever she comes to Australia. Good luck to Celine. I know she's been unwell lately. But, Derek, no wonder he got that one. Forget his thrash metal, mate. He's a Celine Dion fan.
Very nice. I'll jump in with my team.
Go for it.
from the storied grounds of Old Trafford and Stamford Bridge to the equally storied Tarnit Regional Football Facility, it was Western United in their opener against the Newcastle Jets. And the Jets women, for spoiling the party, can have my team of the week. Were you there among the 2040 Hardy Green and Black Souls, Derek?
Do you know what? I had a hair appointment, so I missed it. Tell me what happened.
Well, if you had been there, you would have known in 20 years' time at pub trivia that it was Libby Copus-Brown for the Jets who was the opening goal scorer at this magnificent, although pretty sparse and barren-looking training facility. On 20 minutes, Amy Medwin of United scored their first goal, but that was soon forgotten within a minute as Lauren Allen on the right foot, first time, curled in the goal of the round. An absolute ripper. And then in the second half, Serena Bolden added a third for the Jets. So they moved to seventh, still 7 points off the top four. Well, there's a few issues for United. They've dropped the last two. They had been leading the competition, but they're now a point behind Sydney FC and have played an extra game. At least do yourself a favour, Derek, and check out the highlights and then get back to us next week on what you think of the ground because, geez, it looks like they need a few trees out at the Tarnit Regional Football Facility. If the mercury was to rise, it would be hot out there. They did a few drinks breaks, Rob.
Well, I think they would. And I just wonder if Derek would have a haircut scheduled the next time he heads back to London to watch the Gunners play. I'm sort of wondering about his commitment to the side and, whether the fact that he's prepared to put these sort of thoughts on the record might come back to bite him when they, maybe win the Asian Champions League one day or go to the World Club Championship. You know, come on, Derek. You know, you're a committed supporter. You got to travel out there, mate. It's not that far from Healesville.
Hour and 45 minutes. Single direction, Jen.
Steve Horvath was there. John Aloisi was there. Joey Lynch was there. Aaron Gox was there, who's an Australian comedian, and he's jumped on board Western United. So the quartet were there, Derek, but you were missing as the fifth banana.
I know. And we will come back to stadiums in a minute because I want to do that as my hot topic. Maybe I can go back to back, Jen. So I'll do my team of the week very quickly first. As I realise time is marching on. My team of the week is Fulham. Fulham obviously did what 39 teams hadn't managed to do, stopped Spurs from scoring a goal. They've lost 14 of their past 16 Premier League games against Tottenham, winless in their past nine. But this victory could not have been more well deserved. It was 3-0 goals from Munoz and Lukic. And look, Fulham ensconced safely in mid-table. You know, I think just having another year of English Premier League football is not to be sniffed at when the consequences of dropping down are so dire and the funds needed to compete higher up are so massive. The Marco Silva quietly doing a great job over there, one of the kind of underrated managers in the league, I think. And of course, Fulham play at one of the quaintest grounds in the EPL, Craven Cottage. And that, of course, will lead me into my hot topic, which is Old Trafford. Now, usually called the Theatre of Dreams, was rocking for that FA Cup game that Rob spoke about a few moments ago. But let's listen to some non-United fans singing about the stadium. That is actually some Arsenal fans. I did try and find, was trying to find some Man City fans singing it, but some Arsenal fans were singing it. They were having digs at the Glazers, they were having digs at Ten Hag, but it was the Theatre of Dreams that they were mostly talking about. And there's been a lot of talk in the last few weeks of the proposed redevelopment of the site. A task force has been set up, government consultation has started. A Wembley of the North is the tagline that's been mooted for this one. As I grew up, Old Trafford was the ground in English football. I remember going to my first game there, which was actually an FA Cup semi-final that Arsenal played in. And I was in awe, despite being an Arsenal fan. The Busby statue, the red neon lights saying Manchester United, even the Megastore, which was a new thing back then. It's always been the biggest ground, even with all the new stadia that's come in. They've built it piecemeal in the 90s and the noughties, a little bit like Liverpool have done recently. But there have been recent complaints that the ground is not fit for purpose. Therefore, the song, leaking roofs, broken seats, and just very dated facilities. You know, you look at what Madrid have done with their stadium, Spurs, even Real Sociedad have got this quality stadium there in San Sebastian. Barca are rebuilding. Some of these stadiums in the US, like the one in Las Vegas, is just next level. And just to give you some comparison, Spurs make $6 million a game from their new stadium. Manchester United make $4 million per game. Spurs have got a much a smaller capacity. So that just goes to show that United need this stadium rebuild. Whether or not they do it as a kind of fixer-upper, or whether they put it on the site next to the ground, which they own, and start again. They're the two options. But what do we think, gents? Rob, you know, your Liverpool have sort of kept adding it, plugging away at their stadium. Do you think they need to knock Old Trafford down, or do you think they should try and continue tinkering with what they've got?
It's been a long time since I went to Old Trafford back in the late 80s. So, you know, it'd just be a memory of what it was back then. I hate the idea of knocking an old stadium down. I know how, you know, you still pine for the old Highbury, the location and the memories, the West Ham fans, Upton Park, the Bling Ground, whatever you want to call it. You know, they still crack in the atmosphere at the Olympic Ground, but it's not the same. So I'd say somehow or other, of all the stadiums in Australia, as much as I love the MCG, there's just something about the SCG that has the charm. So, look, I think that's a conversation for another day, because it certainly warrants deeper thought than that. Okay, let's roll into our hot topics, because we've got a clock to watch. Mine's Sam Kerr. I'm going to just be very brief. Since the announcements of the charges a few weeks ago, where, you know, James Johnson, Tony Gustafsson admitted they were blindsided by the whole thing. We all know that the case is going to court on April 26. She hasn't commented publicly on the charge, and we haven't heard anything more from Football Australia. I'm just wondering why the silence. I know we talked to Tracy Holmes in detail about this last week, and to a question that I asked her, have they run out of time? And she agreed that they'd run out of time to deal with this in a timely fashion. I just wonder what they're waiting for. Is it this date? Are they crossing their fingers it's going to get kicked out and there'll be nothing to see here? But what if there is? Where's the leadership that we've grown to watch over time. I just wish they'd come out and say something. They've got to say something. Nature abhors a vacuum, and in a vacuum, rumour and innuendo will fill it up. So I'm just putting that on the table as my hot topic. Where's the comment from head office? Willem?
Would you be satisfied if their comment was, we will wait until April 26 to see if it goes to trial before making a decision?
I think that we are owed some sort of comment, no matter what it is. And if that's the case, then that's the comment. The absence of one, apart from those that we heard at the press conference that day, is, I don't think, good enough. Okay, hot topic from you, please.
I've done my hot topic. Old Trafford's falling down.
Oh, there we go.
Still falling down. All right. It's only been 3 minutes since I said it, but he's still falling down. Do something, Sir Jim Radcliffe.
And in another world, I would have told Adam, just edit that out. But in this case, I think you were funny enough in your response that it deserves to stay in the show. And next time, I will pay more attention. All right, gentlemen, let's wrap it up there. Another nice show. Michael, we think you're out there listening somewhere as you're traveling around Thailand doing your business. So cheerio to you, mate. We'll see you next week. Willem, thanks for another great show.
Thank you, gents.
Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And Adam Maloney, thank you, my friend, for doing the usual brilliant job you do. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Stoppage Time again. Please subscribe to Box Stoppage Time and Offside, which we are going to be releasing new episodes of very soon. If you haven't listened to the old ones, there's a bunch of good ones out there. Make sure you listen to them. Martin Tyler, Paul Wade, Heather Garriock, just three of them. Willem, anyone else that I've missed there? Of course, off the top of your head.
Paul Wade.
Yeah, I mentioned Paul Wade, yeah.
Mentioned Paul Wade. Sorry, I was not
seeing the slightest. See, there you go. So to our listeners who are thinking, hang on, we're listening here. Rob's not listening to Derek. Willem's not listening to Rob. No one's listening to anybody. we're just asking you to keep on listening. Tweet us at Box2Box and follow us on Twitter. Make sure you like us on Facebook if you haven't already, and join us throughout the week as our podcast drop. And we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the world game.